Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
In the gloomy recesses of an ancient manor, nestled amidst the desolate moors, there resided a recluse known only as Lord Ravenscroft. Shrouded in mystery and the whispered tales of his malevolent deeds, he lived alone, save for his faithful servant, a man of gaunt countenance named Grimshaw. One moonless night, as the wind howled mournfully through the barren branches outside, a weary traveler sought refuge at the doors of Ravenscroft Manor. His name was Edward Sinclair, a gentleman of modest means, whose carriage had faltered in the midst of the unforgiving wilderness. Reluctantly, Lord Ravenscroft granted him shelter for the night under the condition that he not wander the halls after dusk had descended. But Sinclair, heedless of the warnings, found himself unable to resist the allure of the ancient corridors. As midnight approached, Sinclair stumbled upon a locked chamber, its door adorned with strange symbols and faded signs. Ignoring the warnings etched upon its surface, he forced his way inside, only to be greeted by a sound that would haunt his dreams for eternity. It said,
"Hello, my name is Luther Abel."
Welcome to episode 58 of the Charles C.W. Cook podcast. Our sponsor this week is Kristi Noem, the incumbent governor of South Dakota and the newest host of QVC's latest hit show, Rushmore State Twitter Grifting. To get your own Kristi Noem, head over to podcast.charlescwcook.com/Kristi and use the code WTF. A warning, though, supplies are limited, and this offer is not available in Nantucket. I had some interesting responses to the question I posed during last week's episode about what counts as a visit to a state. I heard from a lot of people who have made it to all 50 states, including one guy who has been to every state in the union at least twice. Now there's an ambition. Most people who contacted me agreed with my rubric, but not all. For example, I received the following email dissenting from my approach, which I must admit to thinking is extremely convincing. He writes, "I have to disagree with your requirements for saying you visited a state. Sure. On the East Coast, you could drive through Rhode Island or Delaware without even noticing it. But I'm a West Coast kid, and we build our states bigger out here. Driving across Utah, Oregon, Texas, or my great state of California could take you over mountains, across deserts, and past one incredible vista after another. Even if you never get out of the car, although driving across Texas without a bathroom break would be very impressive, you have definitely visited that state." Good point. Well made. Perhaps we need a separate set of rules for Western states than for Eastern states. A sort of states visited federalism, if you will. Another guy provided a slightly more subjective twist on my rule. He wrote, "My criteria for saying I visited a state is if I have a memorable event from that state. I've been in 49 of the states, but only have specific memories of events in 44. So after I retire, I will be off to Arkansas, Missouri, Rhode Island, North Dakota, and New Mexico. That seems fair, too. If you don't remember a state, you probably haven't been there. Or you went to New Jersey. I even got a question about an interesting loophole, namely, what if you drive through Kansas and only stop at the U.S. Cavalry Museum on Fort Riley? It's federal land and more America than Kansas in nature. I did not spend money in a way that was subject to Kansas sales tax. Does that count? Good question. I'm going to count that, yes. It's a curious one, I agree, but I think it would count. The Statue of Liberty is on federal land. Suppose someone went there and only there. Would we say they had visited New York? I think we would. Perhaps the Statue of Liberty is more New Yorkish than the U.S. Cavalry Museum is Kansas-ish, but you have to draw a line somewhere. The U.S. Cavalry Museum is a stop. It's in the state. You have to be in the state to get there, so it counts. And of course, while you're driving across Kansas, you're probably going to want something to listen to. And as such, it is a good thing that our friends at the Competitive Enterprise Institute are back with new episodes of their breakout How the World Works podcast, which is hosted by author and political commentator Kevin Williamson. If you're not already listening to that show, you should be. For each episode, Kevin sits down with notable guests for candid conversations about the jobs they've had and the role of work in the economy and our social lives. From flipping burgers and tending pigs on a farm, to leading special ops missions in far-flung corners of the globe, some of America's best thinkers discuss the jobs they've had that informed their outlook on life and future careers. In a recent episode, Kevin sat down with Jonah Goldberg, an old friend and colleague of National Review, for a fascinating conversation about the ins and outs of Jonah's decades-long career in the media. So if you are driving through Kansas, or if you're not, be sure to listen to How the World Works wherever you listen to podcasts, or you can visit cei.org/How the World Works. Now, I could have done with some new episodes of that podcast this most recent weekend, during which I had to push my £1,000-plus golf cart back to my house from a distance of more than a mile away, not once, not twice, but three times. It turns out that one or more of the lithium batteries in my battery array has a dead or damaged cell. And that because those batteries are smart, they even talk to each other, this does not lead merely to reduced performance, as it would with a lead-acid battery, but to complete and deliberate failure, a fact that I learned while I was driving my parents, my wife, and my two kids back from the beach in 80-degree weather in the middle of the day. Long story short, the little computer on the batteries shuts them down instantly if any of the cells drops below about 2.5 volts. And, well, apparently one of those cells is dropping below about 2.5 volts. So we stopped, and I pushed. Why three times? Surely, I hear you say, after you'd learned this, Charles, you stopped driving the cart around in high temperatures miles away from your house? Well, no, actually, I didn't. I am, as I've confessed before, something of a tinkerer, and as such, I wanted to know exactly when the batteries were failing and under what load, to see if I could identify a pattern and then do the math to work out what the problem must be. So I tested the batteries together, and then I tested the batteries separately, and in both cases, I drove slow and fast and measured my distance and the state of charge, and I whipped out my multimeter, and during this time, I managed to run the cart down, prematurely, all the way down, twice more. At this point, My neighbors must be convinced they live next to a lunatic, because repeatedly during the weekend, they would have seen me cruising up and down our street in my golf cart wearing pajamas. That's me. The golf cart doesn't have pajamas. And then, for no reason that would have been discernible to them, pushing the cart back to my garage under my own steam. Was it worth it? Yeah, you're damn straight it was. I now know the exact problem I have, and I've managed to convince the manufacturer to send me some replacement. So all's well that ends well. Before we get to my guest, I want to tell you about David Barnson's new book. It is deep in the ethos of National Review that work is a bedrock in a flourishing society, and that work is a pivotal component in the God-given dignity of every person. Economist and financial manager David Barnson, our friend and colleague at National Review, has taken this message to its full potential with his brand new book, Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. Whether it be in public policy, in the culture, or even in the church, too often work is seen as a necessary evil and not as the universal blessing that it is. David argues in this brand new book for the economic, theological, and ontological significance of work, suggesting that it is core to our identity and that the fastest way to a failed state will be to continue in this low regard for work that ignores our God-given capacity for productivity. David does not shy away from defending work as a therapeutic, cathartic vehicle for dealing with challenging circumstances in life, and he ultimately argues that the other things we value in a well-ordered life, marriage, children, community worship, and so on, are all enhanced when we properly prioritize and centralize work. It's not a book on work you've ever read, but you should. You can get David Barnson's Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life today at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever fine books are sold, or check out more at fulltimebook.com. My guest this week is Tim Carney, who I've had on the show before to talk about his last book, Alienated America. And I'm having him on this week to talk about his new book, Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. As I just said to Tim, his books have depressing covers. The last one was a picture of a church that had seen better days in the middle of nowhere with no people in it or outside of it. This one has a slide in the middle of a field with no children on it. But the art aside, I have been extremely excited to do this interview because I don't know what I think about this topic, but I'm certainly curious as to Tim's view, in that it is a countercultural argument Tim is making. Mm-hmm. So, Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And why don't you start by outlining that countercultural argument, and then we'll dig into it.
Well, first of all, we have these falling birth rates, record low number of births in recent years, way down from when my wife and I started having children in 2006. It was sort of like a popular, fun thing to do. You know, Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes had a baby then. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie had a baby. The Great Recession hit. Birth rates fell. The Great Recession ended. Birth rates kept dropping. The economy got great. Birth rates kept dropping. And so if you ask people, why aren't the millennials into having babies? Half of the people will tell you, oh, it's because they're selfish. And the other half will say, oh, because nobody can afford it. And I'm arguing that both of those, while not necessarily wrong, they're totally inadequate to explaining what's going on, why people are put off by raising kids, why people are having only one instead of two or three. The word culture is in the book subtitle there. And my argument is that our culture is family unfriendly in lots of ways. And we can start with parenting culture. We can get to the other stuff later. But chapter one of my book, I say, have lower ambitions for your kids. I talk about travel sports, what I call the travel team trap. parents seem to think that the point of youth sports is to develop into a premier athlete, get a D1 scholarship, be the best shortstop or tennis player you can possibly be. And anything less is low quality parenting. Just putting your kid on the local rec team is somehow derelict parenting. And this applies to academics, this applies to music or dance or whatever. Just this intensive, overambitious parenting makes parents more stressed out, makes a whole undertaking look less fun. It disconnects communities from one another, and it makes it impossible to have more than one or two. And the same thing applies to the expectation that we helicopter our kids everywhere, make sure that little Connor never stubs his toe. And police sometimes enforce this by arresting more free-range parenting for parents for letting their kids walk to the park alone. So broadly, our culture is family unfriendly, but the parenting culture and its sort of achievement-obsessed, intensive parenting, that's bad for kids, it's bad for parents, and it's a contributor to our demographic problems.
All right, so before we get to why it's bad for kids, let me just make sure I've got this right. Your argument here is that parents are less likely to want to have lots of children, or perhaps any children, because instead of saying, well, I can't afford it per se, in the way that someone 80 years ago would have said, I can't afford it, they're effectively saying, well, how can I have three kids when I already have to take the two that I have to Kumon and baseball and dance and so on and so forth? And you're saying they don't have to do that stuff, and so you actually can have more kids because we're over-parenting the ones we have.
Exactly. I conducted a focus group as part of writing this book, and the young men, and it was a mixture, some who definitely wanted kids, some who were unsure, and most of them said, oh, I don't want to have kids till I know I can do it right. And they got shown this number by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It costs, you know, $300,000 to raise a child. And they said, well, I don't think that's enough because it doesn't take into account giving the kids the best of everything, the best summer camps, putting them in the best, giving them tutors and all of that. And so when people find out my wife and I have six kids and they freak out, I think they have this image that we are running ragged with each of our six kids to six different travel teams and six different Kumon tutors. And if anybody ever says, well, six kids, how do you do it? The honest answer is a lot of times we just don't. They run around. They entertain one another. Hopefully they play with the neighbors. They play Little League that their older brother can walk them to rather than travel ball that we all need to go to a baseball tournament in Delaware for. So parents are less happy, more stressed than they should be, and that trickles out into the culture. And the norms that are set in, especially elite media circles, is that you do have to give the kids the best of everything. There's a woman, Isabel Sawhill. She and I agreed on everything in my last book, Alienated America, but she's always crowing about how, well, we're having fewer kids and that's great because we're replacing quantity parenting with quality parenting. But I don't think it's high quality, not just because I think that my quantity of kids is just as high quality as everyone else, but I think the overambitious stuff, it really actually deters people from having kids or it makes them stop at number two because they think their job is to be Secret Service agents, chauffeurs, to pay for the best of everything.
You use this phrase, deeper sources of meaning than material success, in the promo for this book. What are those deeper sources of meaning that kids are missing out on?
Well, I think just families aren't developing as much of a culture of connection to one another, connection to neighborhoods. Just think about replacing the local sports league with, I'm going to shop around, find the single best coach, look for what can be the best possible thing. All of that is replacing sort of local connection, community, low stakes bonding. That kind of stuff is where we find deeper sources of meaning. And of course, I'm a Catholic. And so I think that our faith, the fact that every human being has value and that the most important things we're supposed to do, in addition to loving God, is loving our neighbor and giving up time for that. And that just necessarily is going to involve a sort of a slightly slower pace to life than the rat race of high achievement parenting is able to provide.
When did this start? If we went back in time, where would we have to stop to meet the point at which what you're pushing back against began in earnest?
Am I allowed to say the Garden of Eden? No, I'm joking. I do use the Garden of Eden in my book because I say that I don't think millennials are more selfish. I think selfishness has been at a flat level since Adam and Eve ate the fruit. But I think that what's gone downhill is that what society's job is, civilization is there to offset our selfishness. And that's the only way that you sort of convince rational people to have kids in an advanced Western world is say, hey, you know what? You would actually be better off developing some selflessness. And so I would say it's definitely tied to what I wrote about in Alienated America, that the collapse of community support went hand in hand with this high achievement parenting. So the birth control pill came out in 1960, and that's approximately where Robert Putnam and Bowling Alone put the pinnacle of sort of U.S. social cohesion. It became widely available on Medicaid and all sorts of stuff in 1970. The birth control pill did. You had the sexual revolution ramping up in those times, divorcing sex from marriage. But the date I put in my book too, that's also another important one, is when the iPhone came out. That the iPhone in the summer of 2007 and then the flood of social media really detached us from one another, really eroded the ability to build a family culture and brought in all these other cultural forces. So I'm not going to give you one moment in time, like William of Ockham or something like that, like a good conservative should do. But I would say it would go with the birth control pill, the sexual revolution, but also the iPhone.
All right, here is what I think is a problem with your argument. Not with the substance of it, but with your potential ability to convince people to change. You can tell me if I'm wrong. There's a collective action problem here. Someone has to move. Something has to move first. Because otherwise, parents are going to say, well, why me and my kids? I mean, you talk about enrolling children in all these activities, making sure that they're not subject to traumatic experiences, prepping them to get into expensive and illustrious colleges, perhaps with a scholarship. That, at the moment, for better or for worse, and as you know, I think it's for worse in many ways, is how we confer prestige in our society. Mm-hmm. We credentialize so much of modern life. If parent A says, you know what, Tim Carney is completely right about this, I'm just not going to do that stuff, parent B is going to do it. And maybe parent B's kids get into Yale and then make more money, and parent A's kids resent them.
So I've got two. It's a fair concern that's not totally unfounded. The first thing I will point out is that intensive parenting doesn't work as well as you might think. The very first ground I make to an achievement, and I got this from an athletic director who I know, to parents who are like, well, you know, coach, I'm thinking of hiring a pitching coach for my son this winter. He just says, if your son is like 11 or 12 and you're eyeing him being some high school All-American, to say most of his success is up to chance. It's out of your control. That you're going to do this, try to make your kid the best pitcher, and some lacrosse player is going to decide he'd rather play baseball this spring, and he's going to come, and he's just going to be naturally better than your son. Jacob DeGrom, former Mets pitcher, who I think was the most talented pitcher in the last couple decades, he started pitching when he was a junior in college. The starting men's goalie on the soccer team in the World Cup last time, he didn't start playing goalie till some point partway into high school. So the first thing is, it doesn't work. You can't guarantee your kids this sort of success. If you have enough money that you can do what that woman from Full House did and bribe the admissions officials and, you know, put them on the women's crew team and bribe the coach, then maybe you're guaranteed some sort of success. The second way it just doesn't work is that the intensive parenting leads to more childhood anxiety. and that any benefits from getting into Williams or Middlebury is offset by less ability to function as an adult. There was a great op-ed a few weeks back in the American Journal of Pediatrics that said the number one cause, the reason that childhood anxiety and adolescent anxiety is on the rise is because of a lack of independent play. That is, instead of kids being sent to run around the creek or play pickup basketball, they're being put in training and mentoring and all of that, and they're less able to function as adults, and that causes them anxiety. On the last point, it might just be a question of values where I won't be able to convince some people, but I would say having more people to love and who love you, I think is more valuable than having that one or two people work at McKinsey.
One of the things that is different, even for when I was a kid, and when I was a kid, my parents and my friends' parents, I think, were more likely to helicopter than in the 60s and 70s in turn. One of the things I've noticed is that people think that the world is much more dangerous for children now when it's not.
No.
And as a result, kids don't, you said, go down to the creek. They don't go out all day. I mean, it's become a bit of a stereotype, and there's a lot of nostalgia involved, and I'm sure this wasn't the case for everyone. But if you talk to older people, one of the things that they will say to you is, my mother saw me at 8 o'clock in the morning when I left the house, and then 5 o'clock when I got back. And in between that time, she didn't know where I was. There was no cell phone on which she could call me. Mm-hmm. And we just played all day outside on our bikes. And I don't sense that happens in quite the same way anymore.
No. And so there's a way in which things have changed to make that harder that I'll get to in a second. But the way in which some parents think it's changed, which is false, is that there's more kidnappers out there, or it's just not safe. That's just not true. I mean, the 1980s, when my older brothers and I were going across the street to the park in Manhattan, that was objectively much more dangerous. Even with the uptick of crime post-COVID, post-George Floyd, even where I live in the DC area where it hasn't gone back down yet, it's still safer. This is the most dangerous time in 20 years to live in Montgomery County, Maryland, but it's still far, far safer than it was 30 or 40 years ago. The drop in crime in the 1990s was just that significant, and it was flat in the 2000s and the 2010s. I mean, and it went down further. But the ways in which it has gotten harder, A, if other people aren't doing it, then your kids don't have as many people to play with. So that's one problem. B, parents are battling against more addictive or more fun, however you look at it, entertainment in the house, video games, iPhones, that kind of thing. And so those two things do actually make it a little bit harder for parents to let their kids go. But I have a feeling a lot of kids don't run around. At first, when they're young, it's got to do with safetyism, which is a plague where we get convinced that there's a kidnapper around every corner. But a lot of it just has to do with the overscheduling that we were talking about earlier, or like the feeling that it's a waste of time just to go down to the creek. And I sometimes find myself getting annoyed if my kids are wasting times in ways I think are stupid. And that's me being helicoptery. But the second they step outside, they've learned I stop bugging them. So, hey, you know, dad doesn't want us just playing paper triangle football on the dining room table. He thinks that's frivolous. But if we walk down to the creek and catch snakes, that's fine. And so I'm not saying that that's the perfect parenting philosophy. But certainly, I think it's this worry that kids are, they need to spend every waking moment preparing themselves for success in life. That's another obstacle to running around until the streetlights come on.
Explain to me what connection there is between this sort of overparenting and the record levels of depression and medication and loneliness and so on.
I think it has to do with, again, this is what the pediatric psychiatrists say. It has to do with the lack of independent play results in A, just less fun. Kids having fun is good. So like, we should start there. Sometimes, because, you know, I'm, like you said, I'm an AEI scholar, and I try to combine my own anecdotes with my own worldview with tons of social science data, and I skip over some of the important parts. It's fun to play, and when kids have fun, they're happier. But to go back to the social science and the psychiatry, kids making up their own games, going for walks on their own, they develop a sort of skill of making decisions for themselves. My friend and I, Mike Boyle, we would get lost. We would walk from our nice little suburb in Westchester County, New York, into the Bronx, and then suddenly think, okay, we know that that way has got to be west because that's where the sun's starting to set. We need to go north. Let's try this trail and maybe we'll do it. And if not, we'll double back. And if not, we'll cross the street to that payphone and have to call mom and tell her that the sun's setting and we're still in the Bronx and maybe she should come get us. The decision-making process of that, developing the ability to handle yourself, and that the less that if a child is going from school to sport to mentoring and they're just not hanging out and messing around, they have less self-confidence because they have less experience just making things work without parental supervision.
Is there a political angle to this? Is this just a matter of parents making different decisions and the culture shifting, or are there incentives that have been put in place by government?
There's certainly tons of politics caught up in this. There's a bunch of places I could start. One would just be there are a lot of people in this town in Washington, D.C., who think it's better for parents to have no more than one or two kids. And a big part of that is the belief that the two-income family with 40 hours a week from both parents, at least, and institutional daycare, that that is the only appropriate family model. And that's the best family model for a lot of families. Not my wife and I. She stays at home. Stay-at-home moms and stay-at-home dads, they are both very important. Kids benefit from having a parent at home, but neighborhoods benefit from having people at home. But guess what? I mean, you see it in the Biden administration. Not everybody there, but a lot of them think, well, subsidizing daycare, they believe, is better than a child tax credit because we need to get women into the workforce. Why? Maybe it's maximizing GDP as their religion, or maybe it's their idea of gender symmetry. But that idea that women would value family more than work, they think undermines the idea of equality. My version of this sort of feminism is, well, men should value family more than they do, and probably more than work as well. But setting that aside for a minute, that's certainly an agenda that sort of in a resistance to marriage, a resistance to being sort of parents first. That's necessary for this ugly sort of strain of modern gender symmetry feminism. That's, I think, definitely one of the big reasons people are getting married later and having fewer kids, because they've become convinced that somehow that's giving up on really them achieving all of their potential.
Is that manifesting itself more in terms of how people talk and how families are cast, or is that an economic problem? I ask because the child tax credit is obviously meaningful. We don't have universal daycare. That didn't pass. How much of this is a cultural expectation that is reinforced in universities and in Hollywood? And how much of this is the way that we have chosen to set up our society governmentally?
A lot of it is what the kids absorb from culture and their teachers and from their parents. One recent poll, parents of current high schoolers have asked, if you had to choose, your kid has a middling career but a good marriage and family, or career success and no marriage or family, which would you pick? And a majority of Democratic parents who are Democrats, chose the career over getting grandkids. The rest of the population, the entire population, was split about 50-50. And so it trickles down. The good side is that they're battling against human nature. One of the surveys I looked at, the study that was done, and it said something is happening mid-career to women that's making them anti-work. And when I looked at the survey, what really happened is that a lot of women who wanted to be CEOs, they had their first kid, and then when they went back to work, they said, actually, I don't want to work anymore. I kind of want to work about 30 hours a week. I no longer want to be a CEO because I value my family. And so right now, we have a lot of 18-year-olds who are being told your career has to be first and family's just an interference with it. And sometimes nature overcomes that, but we're fighting against the culture. We have to be countercultural if you want to tell your sons and daughters, you know what, the most meaningful thing you can do in your life is get married and start a family. That's going to be more meaningful than any career success you have in life. And so I think there are policies. I complain in the book about my former county, Montgomery County, Maryland, having a better tax treatment for a two-income family than a one-income family, places that subsidize daycare rather than just giving money. But you're right. As of now, the federal government, the compromise between Republicans and Democrats is just give people money. And A, that's more effective for reducing poverty. B, it's more effective for boosting birth rates. And I wouldn't want to see a switch towards really trying to force the two-income institutional daycare model on other people.
Who gets this right? Is it an untrue cliche that the Catholics are still pumping out kids and they've got the balance right and they have the big kitchens with the Italian mother and she's cooking for everyone? Or has this changed? I mean, if you were to point to a group that is sort of, you mentioned Democrats as being the furthest away.
Yeah. Liberal millennials are the furthest away. The LDS, the Mormons, and then you also have, I write a part of the chapter from Utah and from the BYU Idaho campus, where they really support families, where it's just, if you have a kid, somebody's going to help you with it. And they really try to accommodate families and go out of their way. I also write from Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods in Maryland, where I used to live, showing how, you know, you're expected to let your kids run around. And if you see a kid acting up, misbehaving, you as a parent are deputized to yell at them, to discipline them, and then inform their parents about it. That's all stuff that trickles out of the religion. There's not specific Old Testament teachings that necessarily make Kemp Mill in Maryland this family-friendly place, but there is the first commandment, be fruitful and multiply, and then that trickles out into a culture that's broadly pro-family. And the same is true in Mormon parts of the country. I could go into Catholics because, you know, the average Catholic who goes to church every week does have more children. Catholic parishes are not as good at building community, though, as Mormon communities are. My own wife and friends and family, we come from places where it's normal to do what we have and have six kids. We just come from social circles, from Catholic schools where that's normal. And the same sort of thing of more laissez-faire parenting, more delegating to the broader community. And that allows for kids to get the independence and parents to just sort of have fun. And I think if you ask our kids, they would say, yeah, mom and dad and all their friends, they have a lot of fun. And they see us having fun because we're all at the same backyard barbecues and you know, running in the same Little League circles and not going to some lacrosse tournament in Delaware.
Yeah, I actually want to talk about the effects on the adults. But before I do, remind me how old your eldest child is.
We have age 17 down to age 7.
Okay, so 17 years ago, when you started parenting, did you think about this in the sort of abstract intellectual terms you are now, or were you just copying your own parents?
I was, to some extent, copying my parents, to a large extent, copying the other parents around us. So my wife's older siblings, the older friends of hers who had a baby first, the people who are 6 years older and 8 years ahead of you. And so just absorbing it from the subculture. And then sort of noting slowly a distinction between the subculture we were swimming in and the broader culture, especially when you check in at some point with somebody who's stressed out about, is my son falling behind in baseball if he's just playing in this lame little coach pitch league or something like that. But certainly the thinking it through and looking at the social science or anything like that, that did not occur to me until really the last 4 or 5 years.
So let me ask you about how this affects parents. The pediatrician that we go to, the first time we went, astonished me because he asked a few questions about the kids, obviously the standard medical stuff, shots and how are they doing, and looked in their ears and whatever. And then he looked me right in the eye and he said, "And how are you?" And I thought, well, hang on a minute, it's not my appointment. He said, "When did you last go on a date with your wife? This is a real thing that happened."
That's great.
I said, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. He said, "Oh, did you have a good dinner? Did you have time to catch up?" "Yeah, yeah." He said, "You know, that's hugely important to your children, just as much as looking in their ears." And I think he's right. So what effect have you found that this sort of parenting has on the parents themselves, does it change their worldview? Do they get less likely to be depressed or medicated or in debt?
Yeah, so surely the parental happiness is negatively affected by maximum intensity parenting. That's what I'm sort of hoping to tap into with this book, is to say, if you feel guilty, if you feel like you're not doing enough as a parent, probably the worst thing you're doing is worrying too much right now. Now, obviously, neglect happens all the time, but that's not the people who are going to be listening to your podcast or buying a book. The average upper middle class American is probably worrying too much. I don't have as much data on that as I do on the effect on the kids, but certainly that idea, I mean, there was recently a Twitter debate about whether it was okay to bring babies into bars, which is sort of a funny debate with lots of different angles, lots of different viewpoints. But one of the weird responses I got is, when you're a parent, you're supposed to stop being selfish and stop going to bars. And it's, no, I go to parties all the time. I go more now that I'm a parent. So set aside the bar thing for a moment, but just that idea that we're not supposed to have fun, how cruel that is to kids. Kids are sort of having to learn their algebra and their Latin, and not all of them like it. And then they're promised that what parenthood is giving up everything that's fun. No, I absolutely believe that parenthood is about sacrifice and laying down your life for other people. But I also think that that has to be tied up with what's fun and playing with your kids and playing the sports center and going to the creek with them and taking them to parties. And so I do think that parents who just think it's all right to be chill, either let your kids go free or to do low stakes, vaguely fun things with them, they're definitely going to be happier.
So in a sense, it's a paradox, which is that if you are selfish, then you end up more fulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, but ultimately, huge parts of Family Unfriendly I'm writing, this is how parenting can and should be easier. And then I admit at the end of the book, if you do it, it's going to be the hardest thing you ever do. But what makes it rewarding, that deeper source of meaning you asked about earlier, is laying down your life for somebody else. So while it's selfish in a sense, in that I say, you know what? No, Sean, your mom and I are going to have a cup of coffee now, and you got to entertain yourselves. I'll come down when I'm ready. Or I say, hey guys, we're going to this party, or let's go play one-on-one basketball. I'm going to destroy all of you. All these things that are fun that I like doing are part of a broader kind of sacrifice of my life. I don't have the career I would have if I didn't have kids. When I see Dave Weigel writing from a different diner in a different part of the country every week, I think I would love to be doing that. I absolutely love just going around the country, going around the world, and getting to see stuff. I do 10% as much as I would like of that. And that's because I lay down my life for my kids. But I don't think it would be good for them or good for me if it meant my giving up fun stuff, my not having fun, my doting on them every minute.
Let's talk about feminism. You referred to feminism earlier. You said semi-tongue-in-cheek that your version of feminism is that men pay less attention to their jobs and more to their families. That's not what feminism is at the moment. At least that's not mainstream feminism. What role does feminism, as it actually exists, play in this trend you're describing?
Well, so I quote my former radio interlocutor, Jill Filipovich, as saying, women are having fewer babies because they have more choices. And so first of all, there's this argument that the only reason people had as many babies as they did years ago is because women were basically forced into it, like Handmaid's Tale type stuff. Now, that's totally undermined by all the data. The women have the same ideal family size, which is 2.7 children, that men do. And so there's no difference on that. So it's not, there's first a lie that some feminists try to tell that the baby bust is a feminist triumph, but it's not. The second thing is, again, feminism becoming sort of a corporate workism. Because a lot of modern feminism is very atheistic, very tied up with rejecting any sort of faith. And what fills into its place is a new sort of faith. And if it's not going to be based on family, and it's so based on autonomy that it's not going to be based even on community, it ends up being based on work. And that's where they find their meaning. And so they, the way I put it in the book is a lot of modern feminism is about turning women into company men. And I would rather be turning company men into family guys. And that this is, I'm hoping to get some pushback from some feminists. Maybe Jill Filipovich won't like this, but I think a lot of feminists would appreciate this to say, you know what? There is a problem if men aren't, you know, sometimes people see me with my kids, they say, oh, you're babysitting. And I cringe at thinking of how that sounds, as if it's not my mm-hmm. responsibility. But certainly the sad part of it is the idea of, oh, well, what we want is make sure that women are able to spend more time in the office. And by the way, it's good for the GDP. I quote Jordan Weissman saying, he's a liberal economics blogger, saying daycare is just a much more efficient way to look after kids, because you could have like four adults with 16 kids. And that's just much more efficient than one mom looking after one or two. We have to think about efficiency here. And it's just a sad materialistic sort of thing. And so that's one of the things we're up against. Luckily, I don't think it's that compelling. I think people pretty quickly see how dark it is to have your version of feminism be turning women into company men.
Yeah. So I suppose this is an awkward question that might get both of us into a fight with feminists. But where do you think this comes from? Is it your contention that women have in effect been lied to about what will make them happy and are going to realize that at some point soon?
Precisely, because this would get us into this question I try to avoid. Say, because you don't want, we all know these people, and it's more common, I think, women slightly older than me, women in their early 50s, where it really was most pounded home that your meaning is going to be in career and family has to take the back seat. Or worse, hey, you can just start having kids whenever you want. Those were both lies that women have been told in America, and that ultimately leads to sadness. One of the ways I try to be a little less obnoxious about it is by saying that, you know, men are also told those lies. But I've always worked at conservative places and that were family oriented. AEI, the Washington Examiner, there I had bosses tell me, whatever you accomplish in your career, family is going to be more valuable. And my older boss was Bob Novak, the great columnist. And I was proofreading his memoirs when he basically said at one point how much he regretted, as his kids were finishing high school and he was just starting to get to know them, how much he regretted putting career over family. And those conservative bosses of mine all right. drove home this idea. So I'm not just saying, hey, girls, you're going to regret it if you just become a career woman, though there's lots of cases of that. I'd rather leave that up to a female author to make that argument. I'm more broadly saying, as a society, it's so easy for us to fall into the trap of becoming too workist, too careerist, and not family focused enough.
All right, here's a thing that I see all the time, not just on social media, but in the newspaper and in the opinion pages as well. It is selfish for me to have children because of climate change. I can't have children because I'll be killed by climate change. That is crazy, right?
It's absolutely crazy. And actually, one of the best things I read on this was by Ezra Klein in the New York Times. And he said, the question I get asked the most at dinner parties or public events is it okay for me to have kids? And I just thought, oh my gosh, imagine going to the wonk blogger to ask him if you should have kids. But Ezra says, absolutely, it's okay. And it's stupid to not do it. And he points to the fact that like the most alarmist climate scientists tend to have kids. And he points out that there's two streams to this argument. One is the world's going to be on fire, so I'd be bringing a kid into a terrible world. And two is the guilt. Well, every human is, I don't know, 50 billion tons of carbon dioxide. And so it's immoral to bring the child in because it will harm the rest of the world. And what Ezra Klein points out is that the first argument is just BS. If you live in a wealthy country, you're not really going to suffer a lot from climate. that's just not going to happen. And so he thinks that the I'm afraid of the world being on fire story is a cover story for guilt. And in his mind, it's just climate guilt. But I think it's obviously the climate guilt is a totem for something deeper. It's a totem for a deeper guilt, a broader idea that humans were a mistake, that or at least, if not the whole species, at least whatever your us is, wealthy white people, the residents of Park Slope, whatever your sort of view of us, you say, we are not good. On some subconscious level, I absolutely think that that is driving the guilt and that is driving the baby busts. And it's one reason why Mormons are more likely to have kids, why church-going people have more kids. Church-going people are more likely to be optimistic about the future. It's one reason why the baby boom happened. And it happened in the United States far, far more than it happened anywhere else, because we came home, the men got off the boat, and the women greeted them on the pier, and the men said, we just defeated Hitler and another evil empire out there too. And the women said, we just kept the economy going. And they smooch on the pier, they get married, and they have a bunch of babies. There wasn't a baby boom in Italy or Germany or Japan. They had the lowest birth rates for a while in the second half of the 20th century because they didn't think they were good. We knew we were good in the United States back then. They didn't think they were good. And now I think what's going through the minds of a lot of liberal millennials is the same thing that was going through the minds of the Germans in the 1970s and the 1960s, is, are we really good? And I think that deep sadness is an underappreciated cause here.
That's fascinating. You're talking about antinatalism. This is a huge topic. But in addition to that, which is civilizational underconfidence, and climate change, which is eschatological fear. Mm-hmm. What other forms of antinatalism are we fighting against? There's an economic form you seem to have touched on, which is holds that there's a perfect number of children to have. And almost China's policy, but not maybe one child, but that the right number is two or three.
Well,
you think that's a thing?
I think there's a philosophy under there that's also pernicious. And this is what I address in the sort of second to last chapter. I end the book with talking about the civilizational sadness we were just talking about. But the belief in planning, of sterilizing our life free of all risk. I start with Paul Ehrlich, the infamous predictor of doom. And one of the things that made him write the population bomb in 1968, deciding that the world was doomed, was him going on a cab ride through Delhi in India. And he called it one stinking hot night in Delhi. The streets seemed alive with people. And he means this as a bad thing. People eating, people washing, people sleeping, people visiting, arguing, screaming. And he just goes on about how horrible it is that there's all these people doing all these things. And this belief, like you can see, it's unpredictable. It's fertile. It's alive. And this belief that we can sort of sterilize it all, that applies to life. I think people don't like the idea that sort of life has a life of its own, and that children just totally, they absolutely explode any idea that you can plan your life like an architect, that you can write a life script and follow it. That all goes out the window the moment you have a baby. And because they're screaming and crying and pooping. And so I think, again, this is part of the reason that I talk about the birth control pill, but I bring up COVID in this too. This, you know, human faces, human breath is offensive, but chemistry and planning can overcome all of this. That, I think, is another deeper force that's driving us against having kids, because having kids is sort of throwing up. I quote the great philosopher Mike Tyson, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. And so, like, whatever your life plan is, a kid is a punch in the face. I quote Charles Fane Lehman. I don't know if you've ever had him on the show. Charles Lehman is great. And he said, every single child is an unplanned child. Because you might have decided to have a child just at this moment, but the kid comes out and they're their own person. And so I'm hoping that driving home those ideas, A, makes people think, okay, fun in life involves a little bit of unpredictability and chaos and being alive. And my kid's his own person, so I don't think I can control his outcomes too much.
All right, last question. You are made emperor for a day. Well, actually, you might not need to, because you could probably just run for election and have your family vote for you and you clean up. And you get to implement whatever pro-family policies at the federal or state level that you want. What are they?
So I was hoping, by the way, when I did the research on this book, that I would come up with some like bold idea.
I know, because you told me last time you don't do the chapter at the end where you say how to fix the world.
Well, but the part of the problem was that the research led me to believe we should have a child tax credit that is slightly bigger than we currently have.
And not just because you have six kids, right?
And not just because we have six kids, but that's but just to sort of equalize tax treatment between big families and other households. But if it's too big, it undermines marriage and thus undermines family. So I'm not going to go for that. I mean, honestly, I would make it easier, whatever it took. It'd be sidewalks, bike trails, basketball courts, whatever it took to make it easier for kids to run around. I would make sure that there was crosswalks were good enough, that the cars weren't going too fast, that the playgrounds were everywhere. I wouldn't let anybody put up a sign that said, you can only use this field if you have a permit. I would tear down all those signs, and the kids are allowed to play stick ball or pick up basketball wherever they want. I would allow the kids in the bars to go back to that one, or at least some of the bars, that parents, whatever would lead to sort of maximal kid freedom. If I really wanted to be a dictator, because you were saying there's some of this collective action problem, yeah, I would ban travel sports. That would be my one dictatorial action. If you want your kid to play baseball, he's got to play Little League or on the school team. That would be, if I really believed in being a dictator, that would be where I would go. But as far as actual practical governmental policies, it would largely be whatever it takes to allow kids to run around the neighborhood in whatever neighborhood they have to live in. And then when the street light turns on, that's when they come home.
You know, I said last question, but you've just made me think of what I think might be a difficult question. As you were talking then about kids in bars, I was thinking of Europe. I grew up in England, which is not really Europe, but we went to France and Italy a great deal because you can drive there. And I remember being 8 or 9 years old and out in restaurants where people were drinking wine at midnight. You're just there and everyone's there and there's kids and grandmas and families, but they have a birth rate problem, right?
Yes. So this is why, I talk about our culture being the problem. And America has some cultural problems that other places don't. Other places have cultural problems. We don't. I think the sadness, the hedonism, I think that's worse in Europe. I think you talk to young Spanish people, they're even less likely to think that there's a future. So that's why I think the civilizational sadness is a common thread that ties through all of it. England has some of its own unique anti-family problems. The U.S., I think our car dependence is the one that makes us stand out from Europe. But I do think the lack of belief in our own goodness is really the common thread that connects South Korea to Germany to England to the U.S. That's a cultural trend that's in common between all these low birth rate civilizations.
So you would agree with me then that the biggest challenge, or at least one of the biggest challenges that faces us, is to sweep away this 1619 Project style idea that the United States is a terrible place that is built on a lie, rather than a normal place full of hypocritical history. Because you think without that self-confidence, we can't fix this problem.
There's a lot we have to do to rebuild that self-confidence, but that's one of them. Sweep away that lie, sweep away the climate alarmism. I mean, I don't know if you notice this, a lot of the climate publications, writers, columnists have said, well, we tried for about a decade to just exaggerate the problem, and that was probably a mistake. So they admitted that they were lying, basically. The 1619 attempt to make every white person feel guilty and every black person feel like they are, the world is against them and they have no chance. But to go back to the achievement stuff for a second, I think that's rooted in the sadness too. Because again, it's rooted in the idea that your value is entirely in your world's successes. So really just being more open to and welcoming of life and optimistic and in our case, I'd say patriotic, that's going to be at the heart of turning it around.
Yeah, and we've ended up here, which is, I think, fitting given your faith, at a Christian position, which is that life is in and of itself glorious and worth defending, and that it's not subordinate to economic questions or credentials given out by elite institutions. And you said this last time on this podcast that, well, of course, everything you write is tinged by that, but it's interesting to me that this book seems to have the same ultimate conclusion.
It's certainly the idea that material fixes could fix this problem. I don't accept that. I do think it's a sickness. I say it's got to do with our anthropology. You could call it a spiritual sickness. I don't know if I make the distinction between sort of bad philosophy and anthropology and a spiritual sickness, but I certainly do think that our conception of what humans are, deeper philosophical thing than a child tax credit is going to get at. That's the root issue here.
All right. When's the book out?
March 19th, which if you're a Catholic, you know, is the Feast of St. Joseph.
Is that deliberate?
No, that was providential.
And where can everyone get it?
It should be everywhere. It's certainly on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. Buy it at your local bookstore because that's what the New York Times bestseller list cares about. The more liberal the bookstore, the more they count each sale there. So,
yeah, remind everyone of the full title.
It is Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be.
All right. Fantastic. Tim Carney, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And that's all we've got time for this week. Thank you to my guest, Tim Carney. Thank you to my sponsors. Thank you to the golf cart battery that I've been recording this using for holding out throughout. Thank you to Lord Ravenscroft for letting me sleep at his house. We'll see you next week.